Okay, Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution of the United States of America. This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. So therefore, anything repugnant to this Constitution is null and void. And I just want you to know that any kind of a treaty that would be made that would be overthrowing the Constitution would be unconstitutional. Any kind of an act that would be made contrary to constitutional law would be unconstitutional, therefore null and void. So we want to view, just as this says, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. Anything repugnant to it, you can totally 100% disregard. So those of you that believe in obeying the law, that you want to enforce the law, this is where you start, because anything repugnant to this Constitution is not law at all, and you can disregard it. So we need to start sifting out what it is that the government is enforcing that is a personal rule or regulation in a contractual commercial relationship, as opposed to lawful constitutional laws of the land. Okay, back to the chart, and we have across from the people, draw a little bit of a line here. What we're going to do is say, okay, we have gold and silver as our lawful money of account. So how are we going to introduce that money into the system? Well, first of all, the people are going to have to go out and mine for the gold and silver. They get the gold and silver, then they can go ahead and spend it as gold dust and silver dust if they want to get their wherewithal. Okay, then we go down to the national government and say, okay, fine. The national government was given what? The power under Article 1, Section 8, and that is in clause number, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, clause number 5, to coin money, regulate the value thereof, a foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. So the national government was given the power to coin the money for the states. Now, that does not say print paper or counterfeit paper currencies to introduce as money. It says to coin money. Coining is a specific process of coining a metal object in a round form. So that, once again, testifies to the fact that they had to coin the gold and silver for the states, because the states could not introduce anything but gold and silver coin as a lawful money of account. Now, what's the importance of that? Well, that controls inflation, because it has real value to it. Now you just can't go out counterfeiting gold and silver. You got to make it out of a very, very real and valuable metal. Whereas with the counterfeit printing operation of the Federal Reserve, they don't have any expense whatsoever in the counterfeiting of paper currencies, and they can print all they want to introduce them in the economy, and they can manufacture all the bookkeeping industries they want to introduce them in the economy. And the reason for that is that they pay for the paper and ink and the printing presses with the counterfeit paper currencies that they went run off the printing presses. So they have no cost in the counterfeiting operation, just like a counterfeiter. He buys his counterfeiting equipment and his counterfeiting ink and paper with the counterfeit paper currencies that he prints off the press. So he winds up with no expense in that counterfeiting operation. And that's a terrible, terrible thing to allow anyone to have, because they can use that to destroy and ravage the society. Okay, so once again, the Congress has the power to coin the money, regulate the value thereof in a foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. So the question is, who has control of the banking operation in America, constitutionally speaking? Well, now, that's not the Congress. We're looking here at the Congress only have the power to coin the money. Then remember, the states only have the power make anything. They were restricted from making anything but gold and silver coin, a tender payment of debts. Then we go back to our Bill of Rights. Article 10, as we discussed before, says, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Which means that since we did not give our government employees the power to run a national bank in this country, that was our reserve power. We're the ones that's supposed to be running our banking operation. We're supposed to be our own banker. Now, if you'll just go down to the old buildings in any big cities and go through each of the floors and search each of those floors, you'll find safes, old safes on those floors that are probably empty now, that gold and silver used to be stored in. The reason the safes are there is the people were their own bankers. Well, that's not true anymore, because now we have the Federal Reserve, a foreign financial power, controlling how many bookkeeping entries each of us owe to the other. So not, they're not really banks, because they're not storing money. They're storing counterfeit paper currencies and nickel copper slugs. Now, what that means is that they are an accounting division for the Federal Reserve, not a bank, accounting for how much in worthless paper currencies or bookkeeping entries each of us owe to the other. So they're just an accounting division. That's all they are. By the way, there's no constitutional provision for that, so therefore it's repugnant to the Constitution and it's null and void. Now back over to the chart, we'll see that the people go out and they mine for the gold and the silver, and they can go ahead and spend the dust if they want to, and then they have the power to bring it down to the national government. The people and the states can send it to the national government, and the national government here, by constitutional authority, has the power to put that into coin form. Now the national government would get a piece of that, like 10% for coining that money, and they return the coins at less than 10% back to the people and back to the states for introduction to the economy for value. Okay, now here is a tax. This is called an excise tax on a thing. Okay, does the national government have the right to levy that excise tax? Well, here it is under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and the general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So they had the power, first of all, to coin the money and then collect a tax for doing it to pay for the cost of running the national government and, of course, the coining of money operation for the states and the people. Now, the question is 10% of all of the gold and silver that is required to be coined for the people of the United States of America, is that a lot of money? 10% of all the gold and silver? That is an incredible amount of money right there. And more than enough to take care of most of the needs of the national government. So the provision was there to take care of them without income taxes, without Social Security taxes. You have to realize that we had government services throughout this country. We had the real roads being built, the roads being serviced, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, by the government long before we had any income taxes, Social Security tax. And what the government wants you to believe, they want you to believe that the income taxes and the Social Security taxes go to paying for education and they go for paying the paving of the roads, and we wouldn't have any roads or education if we didn't pay those taxes, when in fact the gasoline tax is what pays for the roads. So they're lying to us. They're lying to us saying the income tax pays for something that it doesn't pay for. The gas tax is more than enough to pay for the building of the roads, and they steal money from those accounts for other expenditures, so that we're paying really more for the roads than what we would have to without paying the income tax at all. And I'm going to define to you what the income tax is and what it's for here in very quickly as we get into the democracy presentation, the democracy versus republic. Okay, so the money is coined for the states and the people. The people get a hold of the gold and silver and they go out and they buy property. So to the left and to the right side of the chart, on the left-hand side of the right side, put the word property in, because the people now buy property with gold and silver. And by the way, in the constitutional Republican form of government, these are people with no benefits from the government, no Social Security numbers from the government. They have a right to own their labor and own property. Therefore, they use the gold and silver to buy the property. Remember that you can only pay your debt in gold and silver coin. Therefore, when you pay your debt in gold and silver coin of the Republic, now you own the property. Now you have a right to control property. The definition of ownership equals control. So under property, right ownership, and that equals control. If you ever want to determine who it is that's owning or claiming ownership over property, you look for control. If someone, you have to go to someone else to get permission to use that property, then you know that you don't have ownership because you do not have control. They have ownership because they're controlling it. Okay, so in the Republican form of government, you pay for it lawful money of account, you're a free individual, you're not a slave of the state, therefore you own the property, therefore you have ownership and control over the property. Now we're going to go to Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, and we're going to go all the way down to Clause Number 17. This is the congressional power of the national government in Washington, D.C., to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square, as may by session of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. So now here is a very, very limited jurisdictional authority for the legislative bodies in Congress to function with in Washington, D.C. So, we're looking at Washington, D.C., and then, of course, areas ceded to it by the states for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. D.C. is 10 miles square originally by constitutional law. They have now expanded to 66 miles square approximately, give or take some a mile or two or whatever. And they also have now, as enclaves of the U.S. D.C. jurisdiction, American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands. The state jurisdiction now would be limited to the constitutional authorities of the delegated to the government employees in the state that you're referring to. So what we're going to do on our chart, we're going to draw a little chain around the national government and around the state government. We're going to call that the chains of the Constitution. That's a chain around the national government, a chain around the state government, and right in the center, right, limited constitutional jurisdiction. That's all the jurisdiction they have. So the question is, when they pass these legislative acts, are they passing it to control their jurisdiction, or are they using it to infringe and interfere in our jurisdiction? Now, what's the jurisdiction of the people? Okay, whatever powers we did not give the government, we retained those rights to ourselves. That's our jurisdiction. It's not theirs. So we have a right of ownership of our labor. We have a right of ownership of property and control of that property and use it freely as long as we do not infringe upon someone else's right to life, liberty, and property. So anytime they infringe upon that, they're interfering in our jurisdiction. As we're talking about jurisdiction, I just want to interject a quote by one of our founding fathers, the famous and notorious Thomas Jefferson, who was actually viewed as a radical in his day and as a patriot. And he said, quote, "The central bank is an institution of the most deadly hostility existing against the principles and form of our Constitution. I am an enemy to all banks, discounting bills or notes for anything but coin. If the American people allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children will wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered." Over on the Republic side of the chart now, we want to go ahead and add that we have the control and ownership of property that we already have, and then use of property freely as long as we do not use it to deprive someone else's of the right to life, liberty, and property. So free use of property, free use of our bodies, as long as we do not use it to injure someone else or something else. And if we do injure someone else or something else, we have a responsibility to pay for it. And how is that done? Of course, through a common law jury process where the jury is the judge, decides the issues of laws and facts, and renders a final binding decision. And we certainly cannot trust government employees with that important responsibility that are paid by a foreign financial power where three-fourths of the members that Federal Reserve are not even United States citizens. So we certainly can't trust people paid by a foreign financial power, which the judges are today. Now, I want to make that very, very clear now. Your government employees and the judges in this country, they're all paid by a foreign financial power. They're not being paid in a lawful money account. So the question is are your government employees serving you? Well, they're not obeying the constitutional law that we set up for them, so therefore they're not serving you. Number two, why is it they're not serving you? Well, the answer to that is you're not paying them to serve you. If we were paying our government employees a service, we'd be paying them in gold and silver coin. We're not doing that. A foreign financial power is paying them in Federal Reserve notes to work for the foreign financial power. In other words, the Federal Reserve through the banking industry has taken over all the financial systems of America and have perverted our government employees into their service and out of our service. Now, the only way we can get that back and to recover that is to correct them through the jury system by not guilty until the juries are empowered once again as the judge in the court case is empowered to decide all the laws and the facts, and the judge just sits there as a referee and obeys the will of the people to serve the people according to the constitutional law and not according to the dictates of these Federal Reserve banking institutions. It's time for the portion of our lecture to learn the distinct characteristics of free sovereigns. So on the right-hand side, we're just going to make a line there and write down characteristics of free people. So this is what your character should be if you're free. And one of the difficulties of saying the word free now, government employees are trying to make it sound like people who call themselves free are people who are armed and dangerous with weapons, who make bombs, who blow up buildings. And that's just a con job and a fraud to con other people who are in the system to think about people who consider themselves to be free as bad people. Well, I have news for everybody. I don't make any bombs, and I don't keep any loaded weapons around. I don't threaten anybody with an injury to the life, liberty, or property, and I consider myself free. So it's okay to be free and to be harmless. So let's call myself, I'll call myself a harmless, free, natural individual. And that's a category I'm going to encourage people to get into. We're not interested in going to war and destroying buildings or killing people. That's not what our intent is. Our intent is to make a correction of government and get them out of the people's jurisdiction back into their jurisdiction and teach the people that their jurisdiction is to control and maintain a constitutionally lawful government according to constitutional contracts and keep government employees in their box, which is their jurisdiction, and out of our jurisdiction. When government employees leave that jurisdictional authority, they're invading our jurisdiction. Now, characteristics of free people would be, number one, free people would have no benefits from government. Okay, and I'm going to draw a scenario on that. Let's say I'm a rancher on a ranch, and you're my employee. You work for me. And I go to you and I say, would you do me a favor? Would you give me a retirement program? If I pay you so much a month, will you take care of a retirement program for me and pay me back a monthly income at age 65? Now that sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? I'm going to my employee and I'm asking for my employee to benefit me. In other words, you have to view government in the proper perspective. These are government employee hirelings that are under your feet. You are the master, they are the slave. They're under your feet, they're not over your head. You only go begging for benefits from people who are your master. You don't beg for benefits from people who are your slave. So you have to stop that practice. So free people have no benefits from government. In other words, we don't ask for benefits from our government employees. Number two, free people would buy properties in lawful money of account, gold and silver. Okay, so buy properties in gold and silver coin, lawful money of account, because that is the only money that can be used to pay for debt. If you don't use gold and silver to buy your properties, then you cannot possibly claim any ownership over the properties, because the Federal Reserve notes are owned by the Federal Reserve, a foreign financial power. They're rented in the circulation. Therefore, they cannot be lawfully used to buy and own and control properties. Now, I realize you can't go out buying everything with gold and silver, but you can get your major purchases with gold and silver. There's many different ways to do that, and we'll speak about some others when we get into other sessions of the lectures. Now, number three here, after buying the properties in gold and silver, we're going to say that we do not register properties with our government employee hireling servants. In other words, if you had an employee working for you, wouldn't it be ridiculous to say, go out and buy a brand new car, and you say, okay, employee hireling servant that works for me, would you please register my car under your jurisdictional authority so you can have the authority to tell me how I can and cannot use my car? No, that would be ridiculous. You wouldn't do that. So once again, these government employees are employee hireling servants. You don't register your car with them so that they have the power to control it. The same with a house. You don't register the car with them. Now, next, we would have no debt. No debt in credit cards, no debt mortgages on the houses, no debt mortgages on the automobiles, etc. You have to have no debt whatsoever. Remember, that's one of the characteristics, and you'll find that on the biblical tape, that God's people are not debtors, they are the lender, because a borrower is a slave to the lender. We're not to be the slaves, we're to be the masters. So therefore, you have to learn how to be satisfied with what you own. Number one, don't go out buying things you cannot afford and save up your funds until you can afford to buy it. Now, you're going to ask me, well, how can I do that? All my funds are going out every month. Well, the reason you can't afford to do that now is because you're a slave. You've been paying for all the slave benefits from the system, which include the necessity to pay income taxes, Social Security taxes, buy all kinds of insurance policies and get into IRA programs and KEO programs to reduce taxation, which means that after you pay all those expenses in the system, you're poor, broken, starving. starving for freedom. So all you have to do is eliminate all those expenses, and that means now you can save. Now you'll be able to pay for things in full. Now you won't have to borrow anymore. Now what the government is trying to do is keep you perpetually in debt so they will perpetually own you, because once again the rule of law is the borrower is a slave to the lenders, and as long as they can con you into remaining a borrower, they can keep you to being a slave forever. So extremely important characteristic, no debt. Okay, and I think we already talked about this, but I want to write it down here. Of course, no Social Security numbers from government. In other words, you are not to be a numbered slave of the government. Remember, the rancher claims ownership over their property by numbering it, so they can control it, identify it as their property. Well, that's what they're doing to you. They're claiming that you are their property when they number you with a Social Security number. Number six, you would have no birth certificates issued against you from the government. That's another way that they identify you as their property. And this is extremely significant, although it doesn't superficially seem to be, but it's significant because they are registering those birth certificates with the Department of Health, Education, Welfare, and the Department of Congress in Washington, D.C., which registers that birth certificate under their jurisdiction in Commerce. Okay, so from now on, you're not going to have any birth certificates on your child, so you're going to say, okay, now, how can I do that? How can I avoid having a birth certificate on my child? When they're born in the hospital, they're going to put one on them automatically. They're going to sign a Social Security number automatically. Well, we are not going to have our children in hospitals anymore. We're now going to have our children at home. So put on their home births. Okay, so home births for the children. No birth certificates on the children. No Social Security numbers on the children. Now they're going to be free. I was in a lecturing to professionals in Ohio. These were accountants, these were lawyers, these were lectures on the constitutional law. And I was reading the law, and because I was presenting it in the proper way that they didn't understand, I was accused of perverting the reading of the law to twist it to my benefit. So I would try to confuse them. And I says, wait a minute. I says, I am not perverting the law here. I'm reading a verbatim, and that, by the way, that's my habit. I always read it right out of the books themselves. I don't put my embellishments to it, except when I'm outside of those specific quotes. But I specifically quoted, and I told them I was reading right from the law. That's not my personal opinion of it. And I says, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to test you guys. You guys are smart. You're professionals. And I'm going to test you to find out what you know about the law. Is it the law that required by law to have a Social Security number for your children when they reach age 5? And these intelligent professionals raised their hand and said, yes, age 5, you have to get a Social Security number for your child. That's the law. And I says, you guys should know better. That is not the law. The law says that in order for you to deduct your child off your tax return as a tax deduction, you are required to sell your child into a lifetime of bondage for a Social Security number so that you can take that deduction off your tax return. And that's what the law says. And ladies and gentlemen, I just want you to be aware of the fact that when you get a Social Security number for your child, you have sold your child into a lifetime of bondage and slavery for a tax deduction on a return. That's a terrible thought when you consider it. Praise the Lord, I have raised 2 children without any Social Security numbers. And I'm extremely happy to say that I had the foresight to do that, and it was only by the grace of God that I had the inspiration not to sell them into bondage. And I encourage you that if you have sold your children into bondage for a Social Security number, to remove them from that bondage. Okay, the definition of licenses is permission to break the law. Now, what is a license for? Well, a license is permission to use someone else's property. For all of you that are computer buffs, that have probably have acquired software from software companies, are probably aware of the fact that you have never bought software. And typically speaking, what I'll do is I'll ask people, how many here bought software? And everybody will raise their hand that's into computers. And then I'll say, no, you have not bought any software. What you bought was a license to use the software from the manufacturer, which only gives you permission to use it, not to reproduce it and sell it. Now, if you bought the software, you could reproduce it and sell it to other people and make a lot of money off of their research and development. So they restrict you. They say you can only buy the license to use it, and they give you the parameters with which you can use it. You're limited to that, and if you violate that, you could be charged criminally with civilly and criminally. You could be charged with misusing their product. in violation of the licensing agreement. Okay, so the question is what is a business license? What is a driver's license? What is what other kind of licenses do we have here? Business license, driver's license, marriage license. These are licenses that give you permission to do something that would otherwise be illegal. So we're going to start with the driver's license. Okay, the motor vehicle, when you register the motor vehicle with the Department of Motor Vehicles, that becomes their car. They're the trustee over the car. Therefore, they have the right now that it's their car to license you to utilize their car. Now, if you learn how to buy your own car, then you don't have to get their driver's license. So one of the characteristics of a sovereign, they would buy and own a car as opposed to utilizing the state's motor vehicle. Then they would now have to have a license from the state to use the state's car. Okay, next was a business license. Well, when you get a business license, they're claiming it's permission for you to do business in that particular area that it is. But what you're really doing is you're getting a license that makes the state a third party to your business operations. That is a contractual agreement. When you go out and you get a license from them, now they're a partner in your business, and they have the right to get a fair share of the profits. However, they don't put any investment in there. They don't put any risk in there. They don't do anything but come in and threaten, intimidate, harass, and put all kinds of rules and regulations on you to make it very, very, very difficult to make a profit. And then they take the first fruits of the profits for their benefit. So let's just look at it, you know, from a business point of view, that's a very, very poor partner. So quit making partnership agreements with the state to be a partner in your free enterprise affairs. And the characteristic of a free sovereign would be a free enterpriser. In other words, you would not be in business anymore because you would not get a business license. Therefore, you would be into free enterprise. And free enterprise is the form of government that our founding fathers established for this country. Free enterprise, not business, not a commercially connected enterprise to governmental operations. As a matter of fact, government has got no right to be in business. They only have the right to protect life, liberty, and property, and by getting a business license, you make them a partner to the business. Okay, so the next one is marriage license. Okay, what's illegal, since a license is permission to break the law, what's illegal about getting married without a license? Well, there was a common law prohibition against interracial marriages. The black folks could not marry the white folks could not marry the black folks. That was illegal to have these interracial marriages. So what they did is they started licensing folks that would apply to the government that wanted to get married for one reason or another. They would apply for a special license from the government to give them immunity from prosecution for breaking the law. So the license did not nullify the law that made it illegal for to have the interracial marriages. All it did is give them permission to get married so they could not be prosecuted for having broken the law. So it's permission to break the law. Now, there is no law that requires people to get licenses to get married anymore. It does not apply. You don't have to have a license to get married at all. So it has just simply has become tradition. People think they have to get one because when you go to a state licensed minister to get married, the state licensed minister will say that he cannot marry unless you get the license. So then you'll go down and get the license and he'll marry you. Okay, so a free sovereign would not go to a state licensed minister to get married. The father, therefore, has the right to marry off the daughter because he owns a daughter. So he can perform the marriage ceremony. Or he can appoint someone else to act for him if he has feels a little bit uncomfortable about that. And there are folks like myself who are willing to marry off folks without any marriage licenses and perform those ceremonies. And I'm going to give you an authority for that. First of all, the biblical law supports that contention. And then we're going to go to the constitutional law. And that you'll find the constitutional law under Article 1, Section 10. And it says that no state shall make any law impairing the obligation of contracts or grant any title of nobility. Okay, so a marriage contract is a contract between two parties. And no governmental authorities cannot interfere in those contractual relationships. They are barred and restricted from it. So, therefore, it is not any obligation on your part to include the government as a third party to that contractual relationship. You can exclude them 100%. So that means you don't have a state licensed minister performing the ceremony, the father performs the ceremony, and you record the certificate of marriage in the back of the Holy Bible. Now, if you don't believe in the Holy Bible, don't want to utilize that, you'd make up your own marriage certificate, and you would record that on the marriage certificate with at least two witnesses, and you'd put it in a safe place in order to secure it for presentation at a future time if you wanted to prove that the couple were married and the date that they were married. Now, biblically, by biblical law, the father has a right to perform all of God's ordinances in his household for his family members by a natural right of being a co-creator with God of the children. As a head of the household, he has that right now to perform all of God's ordinances as a natural right, as a co-creator with God, and as a head of the household. So, a free sovereign would exercise those responsibilities of the head of the household to perform those particular functions with his family. In other words, he would not go down to the state and ask for permission for all these things. He would simply carry on those duties. And quite frankly, the only reason we have such oppressive and obsessive and massive government is because the heads of the households in this country have not performed their responsibilities to run their household as the head. They have let that be given up to governmental authority and let the government take it over. Now the government can come into your home if they have some kind of an information or belief that you have spanked your children to discipline them, and they can take your children away from you on the grounds that you're abusing your child and put them in a foster home. And they can do that without any court orders, no due process of law, no trials by jury. And this is a terrible thing. It's Child Protective Services in Washington that's doing that, and there's some serious uprising against those illegal and criminal activities of the state. If you don't discipline your child by correcting your child, and your child goes out and causes trouble in society, you're held responsible for it. If you do discipline your child and spank your child to correct your child, you could be arrested, and your child could be taken away from you'd be arrested for child abuse, and your child could be taken away from you and put in a home that they would consider not abusive. So you lose regardless of which way you go in the democracy. Now, as a result here, we're going to see that we're kind of changing the character of how people behave. Instead of asking now for permission from the government to do things that you have a right to do, you're not going to start realizing that you have a right to do these things, and you're going to do them, and you're not going to ask for the permission. So we don't go to a state-licensed church to be married, because a state-licensed church cannot get involved in things that would abort the government's procedure of licensing. And you cannot go to a state-licensed minister because they can be put in jail on a misdemeanor charge if they perform a marriage without a license. So you don't go to those organizations. Have you ever wondered how come the state church is teaching people to do whatever the state tells you to do, because obedience to the state is obedience to God? Well, that's because they're a state-licensed church, licensed by the government, and if they don't do as they're told by the government, if they get involved in political activities to expose the criminal activities of government, the government will remove their corporate charter and remove their tax-exempt status, and they'll have to start paying taxes on the property. So they'll be punished if they expose the government for the criminal activities. God's church is not incorporated. God's church is not licensed, and of course the Bible is clear about that issue. Christ said that his Father's house will not be a house of commerce. I want to make it clear at this point that I'm not advocating that everybody has to, you know, accept the biblical laws, the biblical ordinances, the biblical commandments, etc., to be, try to join themselves to the Republican form of government in this country. What I'm insinuating here is that in the constitutional free republic, you have a right to choose. Now, I'm saying that you have the power to marry off your daughter, whether you believe in these biblical principles or not. You have the right not to have to get a license whether you believe in these biblical principles or not. That's the point is here, is that we're free in the constitutional Republican form of government to choose to do these things according to biblical principles, or you can choose to do them some other way if you don't accept the Bible. The Republican form of government was made allowance for all people. It doesn't make any difference what your religious beliefs are, whether you accept the Bible or not. It's a jurisdiction that is free for everyone, and no one is required to get these licenses to accept that type of a freedom, or to be a member of any particular religious order to have these principles of freedom working in their life. It's time for a story. I was 7 years of age and wanted to go to work for myself. So my brother was carrying papers and had a paper route, so I decided at 7 years of age, even though I was skinny and weak and small, I decided I wanted to carry all those papers around and make some spending money for myself. And by the way, it was money then, because at that time, when I was that age, at 10 years of age, there was real money still circulating the economy known as silver coin. So I went to my parents and I asked them if I could do that, and I had to have special permission because I was only 7 and no one was authorized to do that unless they were at least, I think it was 9 or 10 years of age at that time. So my parents gave me permission and I got the paper route and I started delivering my paper out at that age. Now, at that age, I had no Social Security number, no requirement to file or pay these income taxes. Now, what I would do as a free enterprise business individual at that age, 7, go down and get my papers. I would deliver the papers, I would collect the money for the papers, and then I would deliver the portion of the money to the paper company to buy the papers. I would keep the leftovers and I would go spend it. There was no deductions for income tax, no deductions for Social Security tax, or any other kind of an insurance benefit program. I was free. I owned my labor. And that went on until I was 16 years of age. I was still carrying papers, still making money delivering papers at 16, and then someone told me I should go get a job at a hamburger joint working for them. So I went down there and I talked to them, and they told me I had to have a Social Security number. I said, well, look, I don't want a Social Security number. You see, I had been working since I was 7 to 16 with no Social Security number, nothing coming out of my pay. I didn't want a Social Security number. I said, I don't want a Social Security number. I have no use for a Social Security number. And they said, well, if you want to work here, you have to get a Social Security number. And I said, I don't want to get one. They said, well, that's the way we do things here. If you want one, you have to get it. So I went down to the Social Security Administration just to find out what it was all about. And I was very, very timid and leery about it. I didn't want to do it. I walked into the office. And by the way, I did not know that I was walking into a foreign jurisdictional office. That was a USDC office where the jurisdiction situs was United States, District of Columbia, American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands. I didn't know I was walking into a foreign office. I went in there and I says, my employer told me I had to get a Social Security number to work for him. They said, well, here, just sign this piece of paper. And they gave me a card, and I signed it. And there was no penalty there. There was no big deal to it, so I thought, well, that was okay. Then I go take that card, and I go down to where I work, and I give it to them. And when I picked up my first paycheck, a sizable portion of my paycheck was missing for benefits. And I said, wait a minute. I didn't authorize these deductions out of my check. I don't want them. They says, that's the way we do things here. If you want to work here, that's the way we have to do it. So what happened? I was free before I got the Social Security number. I owned my labor, got all my pay, was able to spend it as I pleased. Now, as soon as I got the Social Security number, guess what? Now I was a slave. Now they own my labor. Now they took the first fruits of my labor out of the paycheck. Where did they get the authority from? They got the authority from me going down and getting a Social Security number. That made me eligible for benefits. Now the deductions out of my paycheck are insurance premium payments for the benefits I made myself eligible for. Now think back in your own life. When was it that the penalties of these taxations, known to us now as insurance premium payments, when did they start coming out of your paycheck? Before or after you got the Social Security number? It was after, wasn't it? Well, you see, the government is running an insurance Ponzi scheme here. It's an insurance game. They're selling you insurance and charging insurance premium to get it. And you don't understand that. And the reason you don't understand that is because when you buy an insurance policy, you sit down with the agent, he tells you what the insurance policy is about, he charges you a premium, you pay the premium, then he tells you that you're covered. So you pay for it first, and then you're covered. With a Social Security program, it's an insurance program, and you don't understand that because you go down and get the card with no payment. Now you go down to your employer, and your employer takes out the insurance premium payment and sends it to the government. So you're not getting the connection. It's an insurance premium payment for disability benefits, for burial benefits, for retirement benefits, etc. Now that we know that, now we know that we can get rid of the policy. In other words, cancel the insurance policy, i.e. the Social Security number. Cancel that insurance policy. Now you don't have to pay for the benefits anymore. You have to waive all rights to benefits in order to be free. Okay, a Ponzi scheme, just to define it, is a system where the people at the bottom pay for the people at the top to get some kind of a benefit that they may or may not receive into the future. And the word Ponzi came from a man by the name of Ponzi. Now, Ponzi was a very shrewd con artist. What he would do during the Depression is he would buy Chevrolets at about $200 more than what anybody else would pay for them. And he would pay the $200 more because they were in short supply, and he had to pay a premium in order to get them. Otherwise, he was not able to secure those cars. Because he was advertising the cars for sale at a lower price than what anybody else was selling them for, he would get a long line of people paying him a large deposit to buy those automobiles. So what Ponzi would do, he would accumulate a lot of money from all these people paying him to secure a future acquisition of an automobile. Then every once in a while, he'd buy one car from the accumulated funds and deliver that car to the prospective buyer. Now that would excite everybody because they're going to get the car, so a bunch more people get in line and pay the money to get it. Well, in other words, he was not getting enough money from the people to get everybody a car, only the people at the top. So the people at the bottom were putting in funds so the people at the top could get something less than what it was worth. And through the Ponzi scheme, made a lot of money through this fraudulent con job. Now, there's a lot of other multi-level programs going around nowadays that the government is calling Ponzi schemes, but the multi-level programs are going around today. They charge a lot more for a product than what you could typically get it for someplace else if it was buyable on the typical retail market. So it works a different way. In a real Ponzi scheme, you wind up getting the product for less than what it's worth. You don't have to pay more than what it's worth. So these multi-level programs that are going around today are not really Ponzi schemes. They're multi-level marketing programs that function in a totally different way. And many of them are quite honest and great free enterprise type activities, and a great new concept of marketing and freedom and free enterprise that can be very beneficial to free people. I'd like to add at this point that network marketing, multi-level marketing, is a new method of free enterprise in this country that's just breaking out all over, that I believe will give people who are moving out of the corporate state and into freedom and free enterprise great opportunities in developing new and great marketing programs that will benefit you financially and allow you to be able to earn a living and support your family without any Social Security numbers or any business licenses. I believe we've pretty much covered the characteristics of these free individuals in the constitutional Republican form of government. And it's kind of a characteristic of being the master here that we have to be honed in on. We're not the debtor, we're the lender, we're the master, we are the head of the household of our families, we take care of our families, and when we go to the courtrooms, we are the judge if we are on the jury, and we are going to decide cases according to constitutional law. We're going to nullify any unconstitutional acts. We're not going to hold anybody responsible for violating any kind of a legislative act that is contrary to the constitutional law. We're going to enforce the Constitution as a supreme law of the land against our government employee hireling servants, and we're going to hold our government employee hireling servants accountable for obeying the Constitution as a supreme law of the land. And if they breach that contract, we're going to reconvene our common law grand juries, we're going to investigate them, and we're going to throw them out of office if they violate those. And I know these are really kind of high-minded thoughts that I'm talking about here, but this is the direction that we have to go in order to recover our constitutional Republican form of government. And by the way, common law courts are starting to spring up around the country again, and government employees are very, very afraid of these things, and they're going to be coming out with a lot of propaganda in opposition to them. The reason they're going to do that is they've been violating their sworn oath to uphold the Constitution as the supreme law of the land for a long time. They're engaged in criminal activity, and in order to hold on to their position, they're going to get very, very desperate because they could be charged with the crime of treason. In the event that this is going to happen at the time that we're able to recover control of our governmental authorities and bring them back in alliance with the Constitution. If they're held accountable for their crimes, they could be put in prison for many years. As a matter of fact, the ultimate penalty for treason against the United States of America is death. I want to go now onto the democracy side of this chart. So on the left-hand side, at the very top, we're going to put Federal Reserve. And I want to ask you all, what is the golden rule? The golden rule is, whoever controls the gold makes the rules. So the question is who's controlling the gold in America? Well, the Federal Reserve Act was established in 1913, and it was signed into law by Congress, and it was done by fraud. It was an amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America to bring forth the Income Tax Act in 1913 as well. So, we have the Federal Reserve Act, 1913. We also have 1913, the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. So write that on there. These happen at the same times, and I'm going to ask you the question, why did the Federal Reserve Act get passed in 1913 that transferred the power to print counterfeit paper currencies to be lent to the United States government and passed into circulation as money? Why did that happen the same year as the 1913 16th Amendment to the Constitution that passed the Income Tax Act? First of all, the 1913 Federal Reserve Act gave the power to a foreign financial power to counterfeit Federal Reserve notes that were redeemable in gold and silver coin of the United States of America. Not only that, that gave them the power to go to a reserve banking margin of 10%. In other words, they could print 10 times more paper currencies and flood the market with these counterfeit paper currencies over and above what they had gold and silver in the vaults to back it up. That means that they were going to have wild, uncontrollable inflation because they were printing substantially more counterfeit paper currencies than real money that was available to support it. Now, wild, uncontrollable inflation will ravage an economy, and it will destroy the people that created it. Remember, the Founding Fathers had experience with a continental, which was a counterfeit paper money that they introduced into the economy for value. Okay, that reserve banking margin that they utilized, in other words, the printing of 10 times more paper currencies than what they had gold and silver to back it up, led to wild inflation and created the Great Depression of the 30s. And of course, that was done intentionally to bring the United States government into a bankruptcy situation so that they could bring the United States under the jurisdictional authority of the Federal Reserve, because they went into bankruptcy to the Federal Reserve, the foreign financial power. The Federal Reserve Act was extremely unique in that it allowed for the Congress, the United States government, being required to pay to the Federal Reserve in gold every year the current interest rate to borrow the counterfeit paper currencies into circulation. And everybody would say, well, this is crazy. Why would the United States government pay in gold and interest to buy a counterfeit paper currencies in circulation when they could run the counterfeiting operation themselves? Well, you see, the Congress was limited by constitutional authority. They were not allowed to run any kind of a counterfeiting operation to counterfeit paper currencies. They could only make gold and silver coin to pay them a debt. They would have to coin the gold and silver for the states. They were prohibited from doing that, but they did have the constitutional authority to borrow money. So what they're claiming that they're doing is borrowing money from the Federal Reserve, and therefore that's constitutional. Now, it's unconstitutional because they're not borrowing money, they're borrowing in counterfeit paper currencies. If they were borrowing money, that would have to be gold and silver coin. And they can only borrow that in times of an emergency to defend the country against outside aggression. This has led the United States into declaring a lot of emergencies and declaring a lot of wars in order to be able to exercise Emergency War Powers Act, acts are, to continue enslaving the people, to pay additional taxes and justify the borrowing of what they say is money in the economy to defend the country. But they're not borrowing money once again. They're borrowing counterfeit paper currencies from a foreign financial force. And as a result, they have distributed all of the wealth that we had in Fort Knox, the gold and silver, to the Federal Reserve as payment for the national debt, the interest on the national debt, which we owe to the Federal Reserve for having borrowed counterfeit paper currencies into the society. Now the question is, how do we rectify this? How do we pay off this huge debt to the Federal Reserve? Well, it was a fraudulent debt. The Congress never borrowed any money. They borrowed counterfeit paper currencies into circulation. So all you have to do is liquidate the debt. You're not going to pay it. You know, nationalize the Federal Reserve and disband it. And, of course, get out of the business of running a national bank and put the running of the banks back in the hands of the people. And the people have the right to establish that in any way they want to where they reside. And the reason for that is the jurisdictional authority for running the banks is with the individual, not with the government. The government was prohibited from having that power. The individual has that power. Therefore, we have the power to decide how to run our own banking operations wherever we live. We can do that personally, or we can do it collectively. That's our right and our choice. So here we have Federal Reserve Act 1913 creating wild, uncontrollable inflation, which means that there has to be a tool to control the inflation. Now, they knew that they were going to create inflation. Evidence that I have of that? Well, the 1913 16th Amendment of the Constitution to levy income tax. This is Article 16, which most people refer to as the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. Now, this was put in the Constitution by fraud. The states did not ratify this except for possibly one. It was put into the Constitution by fraud by Philander Knox, the Secretary of the State, and he was probably paid off by the Federal Reserve to do this. Who knows? And it gave the appearance as though it had the power to tax people on any kind of revenues that they would earn for their labor, when in fact it did not do that. As a matter of fact, in the Brewshaver versus Union Pacific Railroad case, they made a legal determination that the 16th Amendment of the Constitution did not give the government any new taxing power. Now here's what the Article 16 of the Constitution says. It says, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. So it sounds like they have the power to tax anything that stands still or moves, when in fact it's a very, very limited statement here. It was done that way to con people into thinking that the government had the power to tax you any way but loose, when in fact it never did give them the power to do it. Now what you have to do is you have to, first of all, ask yourself a question. Why was this put in here if it did not give the government any new taxing power? Well, you see, they're creating massive inflation, so they have to have a way to steal it back. When they introduce all this counterfeit paper currency into the society, it creates a lot of inflation. So they're getting something for nothing. Why? They counterfeited the money. They introduce it into the government. They spend it into the government to get goods and services. That creates inflation. Now, if they don't have a method of stealing it back from the producers, and if it's spent again, we're going to run an incredible inflation rate in this country. As of today, they're running approximately $500 to $600 billion per year deficit spending. That means they're spending that much more than what they're taking in on taxes. The gross national product is about $1.7 trillion, which means that they're running about a 33% inflation rate. So what's your income tax? It's about 33%. So they're trying to steal back as much from the producers as they're creating an inflation in order to stay in business. If they didn't tax you, then they would collapse. They would have to go out of business because the inflation would come back to haunt them. People would recognize what they're doing, and they would throw them out of office, and they would go back to lawful money of account. So next, we want to try to understand what the 16th Amendment really did to get a good understanding of how to remove ourselves from any kind of a penalties from the 16th Amendment of the Constitution. Article 16 of the Constitution, once again, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect income, correction, taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. So, we're going to define this, number one, as a tax that the Congress can lay. Number two, it can be on incomes. Number three, it can be without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. Now, we want to go back to Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, Clause 1, and it says, the Congress shall have the power to land, collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and the general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So duties, imposts, and excises are required to be uniform throughout the United States. That's the characteristic of an excise tax. An excise tax is a tax on a thing. Now, the 16th Amendment says it can be levied without any census, without any enumeration. And if you look back at Article 1, Section 8, there's no census, there's no enumeration, there's no apportionment required. Now, we go to the other kind of a tax that Congress can levy. Now, the Congress, remember, they can levy a tax on a thing. Now, on Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, it says, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states. So a direct tax on an individual is required to be apportioned. There has to be a census, there has to be an enumeration, there has to be an apportionment. What that means is that Congress, during times of emergency, like for example war or whatever, can calculate how much money they need for the war. They can apportion that based on the population of each of the states to each of the states. When the state gets the bill, they would apportion that to the people. The people would pay the states would pay the national government. That's what the apportionment clause required. So, we go back now to the 16th Amendment of the Constitution. It says this is a tax that can be done without apportionment among the several states. Well, a direct tax requires an apportionment. It says it could be done without a census or enumeration. Well, the direct tax requires a census or enumeration, which means that this cannot be a direct tax because it would be in violation of Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution if it was a direct tax. Therefore, it necessarily falls under the category of excise taxes on a thing in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Now I'm going to bring up another bold statement. The bold statement is that the Congress, the IRS, has never taxed your pay. You have never had an income tax levied on your pay. You have never had a Social Security tax levied against you. Never. Now, remember, the Congress has the power to levy excise taxes on things. And Article 16 of the Constitution, it's Amendment 16, is an excise tax on a thing. So, what the income tax and the Social Security tax are, what they are, is insurance programs that give you benefits for participating in the program. And the tax that you're paying there are insurance premium payments for the benefits. So the tax is on the benefits, the thing. It is not on your pay. It is not against you. It's on your eligibility for benefits. So if you want to get rid of the benefits, you can get rid of the tax. If you don't want to get rid of the benefits, then you have to pay the tax.